you have beliefs and morals and marriages and children and families and things like that. All of those things have been corrupted by fiat money. You see, for example, with the education industrial complex, with corporate art, HR and things like that, that a lot of people end up taking the beliefs of the people around them in those contexts, which are ultimately controlled by the people in charge of those institutions. And you get the woke insanity that you get right now, because these are not beliefs that have been argued for necessarily. It's like there is an argument, but it's not something that you discover through philosophical inquiry. It is more or less handed down through a centralized influencer or whoever is in charge or whatever. That ends up with all kinds of corruption into your belief system, into your morality, and many, many other things.
Hey, welcome back to the Throwing Mountains podcast, where men are rediscovering courageous leadership. Come join us and you're going to be strengthened from the stories of God working in the lives of ordinary men today. Men who've become leaders in their spheres of influence by relying on God and following Jesus. My name is Mike Hatch, and I am your host, and I'm joined, as usual, with best-selling author Chris Bollinger. And we are so grateful that you joined us today. This is going to be an amazing interview, as well, I guess all the interviews are. But this is a little bit more unique and special in my mind for some personal reasons. But welcome, especially if you're new to us. We're really grateful you chose to invest your most valuable resource, your time, in spending with us. And so today, I want to set this up first, before I bring in our guest, in order to kind of set some context and connect some dots, because I imagine that some of our listeners might feel that this topic or subject matter is a little far removed from our normal content that we produce on this podcast. So I wanted to kind of connect the dots for you guys. We talk about men rediscovering courageous leadership, and part of that has to do with, as we've talked about before, and I talked about in my book, stepping out of the dark and into the light, acknowledging the truth of who we are and acknowledging the truth of who God is. And then what happens is, as Jesus says, because of the Holy Spirit that is dwelling in us, we become the light of the world and the salt of the earth as men. And this is one of the primary ways that God empowers us to be leaders in our families, in our workplace, in the community, in the church. When Jesus says, actually, that we are the light of the world, that's more a declarative or descriptive term about who we are. It's not a prescriptive way to say it. It's not saying you need to be the light of the world. What Jesus is saying is, look, you've got the Holy Spirit and you are the light of the world. And by virtue of that, we reveal things just simply by being where we are in the world. We bring light to things and expose all sorts of truths, some good things about who God is, but also corruption. Ephesians chapter 5:8 talks about living in the light as children of the light in verse 9. And then in verse 10, it goes on to say, and find out what pleases the Lord. And then verse 11, have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. And that's another part of what we're called to as men, as we rediscover courageous leadership, to discover what pleases the Lord, and also to expose what's the corrupt nature of a sinful, broken world around us. I'm excited today about our guest, Jimmy Song, who just recently wrote a book entitled Fiat Ruins Everything. Super excited about this book. And Jimmy, I feel like I've seen you do this a lot. This isn't not new for you, but you've been finding out what pleases the Lord. And I believe it's a profound way of exposing the fruitless deeds of darkness, basically, in what you've written in this book. So Jimmy Song is a Bitcoin developer, educator, and entrepreneur. He's a programmer with over 20 years experience, an open source contributor to many different Bitcoin projects, and the author of Programming Bitcoin, The Little Bitcoin Book, Thank God for Bitcoin, and Bitcoin and the American Dream. Jimmy has been a lecturer at the University of Texas, an expert witness in legal cases involving Bitcoin. That's interesting, Jimmy. and is an advisor to multiple companies. Jimmy writes a weekly newsletter, which I love. I get it, the Bitcoin Tech Talk, and has a podcast called Bitcoin Fixes This. Jimmy Song, welcome to the Throwing Mountains podcast.
Well, thank you for all those wonderful words. I'm always a little shocked when people talk about me and it's all nice. But hopefully I can help you guys throw some mountains. Yeah, interesting name for the podcast, I guess.
That's right. That's it, brother. That's it. So, Jimmy, I'm very grateful for you too, because you have played such a significant role in my life at a time where God was doing some incredible things in me. Previously, I did a podcast with a buddy of mine, P.W. Goepel, called Blue Collar Money, Theories of Middle Class Investing, where we were talking about helping the middle class kind of people take some self-sovereignty, accept ownership for their own financial future. And little did I know that so much of what we were talking about was already being talked about within the Bitcoin community. And we had you come on, and it was just unbelievable how your message just resonated with us and aligned with us. Now, I still needed corrected. There were times where I reached out to you on LinkedIn about certain cryptocurrencies that you would respond back and say, yeah, not interested. It's centralized. And I remember feeling, Jimmy, because I was still in process, but I remember feeling, man, he's just dismissing that out of hand. Like, what? How can you just do that? And you know, you get that response all the time. What I'm talking about, folks, of course, is Bitcoin. And I've mentioned this on the podcast before, and that is that I am a big Bitcoin proponent, and you've heard me mention it, because I believe that it is honest money that abides by God's mandate for just weights and measures, aside from gold and silver. But the problem with gold and silver is you don't control the ledger. That's the problem. With Bitcoin, nobody controls the ledger. We'll get into some of that, hopefully. But Jimmy, I owe a ton to you because you have, over these few years, done so much to educate me, been so inclusive in terms of inviting us to that first Thank God for Bitcoin conference. And my buddy and I, Todd Blummer, came down and we experienced that together with you. And man, I'm just so grateful for your consistent messaging. And what I appreciate is that you don't mince words, man. You're just, this is what it is. That comes from your engineering mind. You know what I mean? You've done the research, you know what you know, and take it or leave it kind of thing. All that to say, I'm so grateful for you, Jimmy, and for the influence you've had on me.
Again, thanks. Like I said, when people talk about me, especially online, it's usually not in such kind words, you know. There's a lot of curse words in there, a lot of people saying that I don't know what I'm talking about, calling me an idiot or whatever, whether from no coiners, all coiners or whatever. So I appreciate that. And there is a lot of substance to what you're saying about this, almost like Bodhi Bokum calls it the 11th commandment of Christians, thou shalt be nice. It's something that I've seen in the church, and we could talk about this in a little bit, but I really think it's sort of like a fiat infection. We've all been sort of psyoped into thinking that that's what Christians need to be, that to be a Christian means that you have to be nice and polite all the time and do things a particular way, when really you read a really secular book like the 48 Laws of Power or something like that, right? Completely psychopathic manual to living a Nietzschean life. That's where you get stuff like being nice to people and getting them to like you and all of that. It's not what Christ did, and it's not at the core of our faith, yet it's penetrated the church in a way that's unfortunate. And it's also made it much less masculine, much more feminine. And I mean, not exactly feminine. It's like a very shallow femininity, being nice to other people and stuff like that. But that unfortunately has become a part of the church. And I like seeing that it's going back in a different direction, especially as we look at a community like Bitcoin, where sort of toxicity and offending people is fine. It's almost like, okay, yeah, that is the truth. And that's what should prevail, and not someone's hurt feelings over insulting their chosen altcoin or something like that.
Amen. Man, I totally agree. So, all right, let's start. I've already taken a lot of time to preface this conversation and connect the dots. So, Jimmy, I want to start with your fence post story like we normally do with every guest. And that is, imagine a fence sits along a property. You've got the horizontal pieces that are held up by the significant vertical posts. And those vertical posts are metaphorical to those significant moments or people in our lives that made us who we are today. You don't have to share all those posts, but we'd love to hear a few of those big fence post moments in your life that God used to bring you to where you are?
Yeah, I think the first obvious person that I can think of is my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, so my mother's mother. She was pretty significant in my life because, well, first of all, she was a Christian. And growing up in Korea, up until the age of eight, I grew up in Korea. And then my father got a position in New York as part of his company. So we had to move and all that. But before then, I grew up in Korea. And one of the cultural things that's not really familiar here in the US is when the second child is born, what you do with the first child is you send them to your maternal grandma. That's a way to sort of offload the stress. I think that sort of thing was common in every culture until, I don't know, maybe like the 40s and 50s when the nuclear family became much more normal. And now you just have to do everything yourself. But back then, I was living with my grandmother for a year or so. And she was like this very small Asian woman, had gone through the Korean War and Japanese occupation and all this stuff. But she had this amazing faith. The thing was, my parents weren't Christian, at least at the time. But she cared about her grandchildren, and she was very insistent to her five children that they needed to send their kids to church. She would tell me about the Bible, tell me about all of that. But more importantly, she was like, you need to send your kids to church. I know you're not going, but you still need to send your kids. So my mom, wanting to, I guess, obey her mom, on a Sunday morning, walked me and my sister over to this building and said, okay, you're going to go up there. It was like a building with multiple businesses and stuff, but there was a church on the second floor. So it's like, okay, there you are. Can you find your way home? Sure. I think I was like 5 years old at the time. And my sister was four. Sure. And then she just left. And that was my first exposure to church. And it was because of my grandma. You would never do that today, right? Even in Korea, that's kind of unthinkable. But this was, what, like 1982 or something like that. So it was totally fine to just walk a kid over and let them find their way home. And that was my first exposure to Christ. And a large part of it was because of my grandmother. And the thing is, she had five kids. And there's 10 of us cousins. Each of our kids had two kids each. And all of us could tell you stories about how we had to go to church, even though our parents weren't going and stuff like that. So that, I think, would be at least one of them. I don't know if you want to hear more, but that would be a major one for me.
Yeah, no, that's great. And then you said you were eight when you were moved to the United States.
Yeah, so my dad worked for a textile manufacturer. I think they might still be in operation in Korea, but basically he was working for a textile manufacturer. Back then, a lot of clothing was produced in Korea. And the fashion designers were in New York, so they're always curious about what sort of clothes you can make at the factory. So you needed the samples closer to where the fashion designers were. So they stationed my dad and said, okay, for the next 3 years, you're going to have to go to New York and be our company representative in New York for the various industrial people that want to see the clothes or whatever. So we immigrated to the US, and it was initially supposed to be for 3 years, but they extended it to five. My dad worked in the Empire State Building, 66th floor, next to the Diamond Exchange, if you guys know what that is. I didn't even know what that was most of my childhood until I read about it in college and how that was the one place where you could go exchange diamonds or when you're trying to sell. And this was reading about the entire diamond scam that happens over the entire world, basically controlled mostly by De Beers and stuff. But I didn't even know that, but he literally worked two offices down from the Diamond Exchange on the 66th floor of the Empire State Building. So that's why we immigrated. And when the 5 years were up, my parents did not want to have us go back to Korea and have this weird transition. And they thought that it was way too competitive in Korea anyway, and that we would have a rough time. So 5 years, it turns out, is the amount of time you need for a green card. And my dad had gotten the green card and he quit rather than go back. That's what happened. But part of immigrating to the US, I think, was really a big blessing for our family because my parents really weren't interested in church at all. My mom, I think, had some exposure, but wasn't really interested, or had fallen away or something like that. My dad had never gone to church. But because we were new immigrants from Korea, they just wanted other Korean friends. And if you know about Korean Americans, it's just that there's a lot of Korean American churches. The joke is that if you get three Chinese people in a town, you'll have a Chinese restaurant. If you have two Korean people in a town, you'll have three churches. So that and that joke is particularly with respect to how often Korean churches split, which sadly sort of informs you about how contentious things can be. But anyway, it was good in the sense that both my parents started to go to church as a result of immigrating. We immigrated, January of 1985, and we were attending a church, I think, maybe 3 weeks later. And it was a fairly new church. The pastor had started it with maybe 10 families, maybe 3 or 4 months before that. Mm-hmm. So we were one of the first families at that church. One of the big impressions that I remember from that point was all through my childhood, my dad was a chain smoker, and not just a little bit. He was in the Korean Army and Air Force, and he would tell me stories of how much he would smoke. He was a 5-pack-a-day smoker. Okay. Like, ooh, this is not a small amount. Tell me about how he would have to have a pack of cigarettes everywhere, one in his front pocket, back pocket, office, home. He would be smoking 2 cigarettes at once because he would leave one on the ashtray so that the ashes would be going down while he'd be smoking another one. This is the degree to how much of a chain smoker he was. A month into going to church, he quit cold turkey, turkey, and never smoked again. Which to me was like, okay, something is going on, because there, like, how do you go from the 5-pack-a-day smoker where we're coughing in the car all the time whenever he's driving us because he's smoking in the car,
right?
To a point where he just quits cold turkey. And, you know, part of it is probably it wasn't as socially acceptable in the U.S. as it was in Korea or whatever. But part of it was he realized he needs to change his life. I attended that church until I was out of high school and all that. But he and my mom were there up until maybe 6 years ago when they moved out to California. Basically, they were a part of that church from almost the beginning all the way up to where it is now. That was a big part of their
life. Did you live in the city, Jimmy? Did you live in the city or were you in the suburbs?
We were in New Jersey. New York? So, yeah.
Jersey.
So
okay.
We were in Bergen County. So at least for me, that made a big impression. But the people at that church, particularly the English youth ministry, was a big part of my growing up. And there were a couple of youth pastors that really deeply cared about the Lord. And especially in high school, I got really involved in the youth group. So that was, I think, for me, another big.
How'd you end up in Texas? You went from Jersey to where? Where'd you go to college and what happened?
Yeah, so then? I went to college at Michigan. I was pretty involved with my fellowship there. And then my first job was in Cambridge. So I went there and I was there for 14 years or something like that. Yeah. I was there a decent number of years. It was like startup after startup, basically. I'm a programmer, so that's what I did for a while. And I had gotten married in 2005, and we had 3 children. My wife was pregnant with a 4th, and we were trying to figure out what to do because she was also working. At least at the time, Massachusetts had a pretty high cost of living. And it's especially like that Cambridge area is just absolutely insane. We had 3 kids already, and we had worked something out. First kid, we put him in daycare, and she continued to work. I was obviously working. Second kid, we did the same. And third kid, by the time the third kid came around, we made a deal with my wife's brother. He was trying to finish seminary and had been trying for 8 years or something at that point. And he had gone to different seminaries, but he would run out of money or whatever. I was like, okay, let's just get your degree. Here's what we can do. Your wife can take care of our kids while you attend seminary, and we'll pay for it. And, you know, that'll be good for everybody because we will have the kids with somebody we trust, and you guys can live with us. We had a basement. And that worked out, except he graduated by the time we were pregnant with our 4th. So At that point, we just had to figure out something. This was in 2012. And something had to give. And I told my wife, all right, there's no way we're going to put four kids in childcare. That's not going to happen. And I asked her if she would be fine staying home and taking care of the kids. After some thinking about it, because she actually had a really good career being an occupational therapist at MGH, right? Amazing place to work and very prestigious and everything. And she agreed, but we couldn't do it in Massachusetts without going really far out and stuff. I looked at that point for the best ratio of income I could get versus the cost of living. Lots of places, very affordable, but they don't pay programmers very much. Lots of places that pay programmers very much, but they have insane cost of living. I could have moved that to Silicon Valley, but that wasn't going to happen because the real estate prices were too high. The best ratio I found was Austin, where they were starving for programmers and the cost of living hadn't risen so much yet. This was 2012, so we moved there. I thought it was going to take a really long time, but they were so desperate for programmers. When I contacted a recruiter, he had a list of 15 companies that he wanted me to be introduced to because there was so much of a demand for programmers at that point. So I ranked them and he got me an interview at the first place that I wanted to go to. I had an interview 3 weeks later. I went there for 2 days. On the way home, they gave me an offer. And they wanted me to start 3 weeks later. Unfortunately, that was the due date of my fourth child. So I was like, by the way, I didn't tell you this, but that's the due date of my fourth child. And they were like, oh, okay. I just come like a month or two later or something like that. So that's how we ended up in Austin.
The Throwing Mountains podcast is part of the BiblicalLeadership.com podcast network. The vision of BiblicalLeadership.com is to lift up Christ, spread His word, and edify, encourage, and spark boldness in His servants around the world. The Bible is, of course, a guide to eternal life, but it's also a real-world guide to living, providing guidance on a broad range of topics, including marriage, parenting, faith, work, and leadership. The folks at BiblicalLeadership.com provide rich content and resources that help leaders use the Bible as a practical leadership manual every day. Be sure to check out BiblicalLeadership.com today.
Oh, okay, you're doing programming. Tell me if you would, because I just remind folks, the book is Fiat Ruins Everything, How Our Financial System is Rigged and How Bitcoin Fixes It. Okay, so tell me, Jimmy, when was your first introduction to Bitcoin?
Yeah. So 2011, I was working for one of the many startups that I've worked at. I think I've worked at like 12 or 13 of them. And I was one of the co-founders for this company that didn't really go anywhere. But I was reading some sort of random tech news just to keep up with what's going on. It was this website called Slashdot, and it was February of 2011. So about a year and a half before I left Boston, I saw this article, internet-only currency Bitcoin reaches dollar parity, and I didn't know what it was. And I started going down the rabbit hole, just, okay, what is this thing? Wait, it's an internet money?
That's interesting. You did not dismiss it right away. I hear so many stories where people hear about Bitcoin and they say, I don't know.
Well, I didn't know what it was. I'm a curious guy in general. So it's, all right, let's go see what it is. I read about it. And one of the first things I learned was that there's a hard 21 million limit. I was a math major in college and I was a programmer. So I had enough of an intuition of cryptography and infinite sums of finite things and knowing that you can get some asymptotic function and stuff like that to, okay, that's feasible. This works. One of the first thoughts I had when I read about it was, I really need to be one of the first people to get this rather than one of the last. Right. I think that's the instinct for a lot of people when they hear about something scarce. It's like, okay, I better get a lot of this, right? This is what happens with concert tickets or whatever back when they were not like $800 or something. It'd be like 15 bucks. But if you're one of the first people in line, you always buy the max amount that they'll sell you because it's scarce and you could resell it for a lot more. That's, I think, a natural part of human instinct to want things that are scarce because you're a social animal and you recognize that if it becomes popular, there's a lot of money to be made and stuff like that. So that was one of my first thoughts that, okay, if it really is 21 million, I had a rough idea of how it could work. That's something that I should look into. At first, I was like, okay, well, how do you get it? And the only way that looked feasible was mining. And even at that point, CPU mining was just absolutely dead. You had to get into GPU mining and ASICs were starting to get manufactured and stuff like that. So I tried to mine with AWS instances that I had control of and it didn't do anything, right? There was no way I could find anything. Tried to find a way to buy it some way. And Mt. Gox was like at the first search result for buy Bitcoin at that point. And it was in Japan. It looked really complicated to get money there. I was looking for ways to buy it with PayPal or credit card or something. Just nobody had any way to do it other than Mt. Gox. So it's like, bit the bullet, tried to figure out a way to buy it off of Mt. Gox. And it was a very complicated process because the exchange is in Japan and your bank account is in the US. You need to go through a money transmitter to get the money to Japan. So there was a money transmission service called Dwolla, and they had partnered with Mt. Gox. So you had to get an account at Dwolla, hook up your bank account, and then they would make two deposits, and you had to verify that those two deposits were correct, and that took a week and a half or something. And then after that, you had to link your Dwolla account to your Mt. Gox account, and then you had to do something similar there. And I started the setup, and I was like, this is too much. So I just didn't buy any. And this was when Bitcoin was $1. So that was, you know, everyone has their Bitcoin regret stories. That's mine. Yeah.
Yes.
Hey, Jimmy, let me take a step back. So you saw an article on Slashdot. I haven't been on Slashdot in a long time, but I remember they were pretty good articles, right? I mean, they're pretty in-depth. You could do a fair bit of research. Other than scarcity, what appealed to you about Bitcoin at that point? Did it look technically well thought out, or what were the main points that appealed to you?
Well, the fact that it was digital was a big one. And I couldn't make the determination if it was centralized or decentralized. I think it would have blown my mind at that point to know that it was actually decentralized. But I just sort of looked at it and said, okay, if you can transact this instantly through the internet, that's an amazing feature. And having the scarcity, those two are very important. Or at least I had that instinct. I had done some studying of Austrian economics in 2008 after the great financial crisis, like the TARP bailouts and all that. So I had some background in Austrian economic thinking to know, okay, this is way more along those lines than the infinite money that fiat money is. So I was very fortunate because I had the technical chops to at least have a decent idea of how it could work. Even among programmers, not many of them have an idea of what cryptography is or how it works. But because of my math background, I had some of that. And additionally, I had at least enough of an economics background to appreciate the significance. And it kind of fit like a glove almost right away. No, not enough so that I opened my Mt. Gox account fully and funded it. But that's, like I said, my regret story. So yeah.
I know it's probably difficult to do, but can you give us the thumbnail compare and contrast between fiat and Austrian approaches to economics? Because I'm not terribly knowledgeable about this. I haven't really read up on it. I've got an MBA, but it was more on the marketing side. I did financial arbitrage classes and stuff, but that was a long time ago. So can you give everybody just kind of level set us on the main differences between the two schools of thought?
Yeah, so Keynesian economics, which is what I would call the mainstream economics. And this is the macroeconomics classes that they teach you in undergrad and business school and stuff. It's based on, I think, what Seyfeddin would call physics envy.
I'm sorry, real quick. Seyfeddin Omous is an author, Bitcoin author.
He wrote the Bitcoin Standard, the Fiat Standard, and Principles of Economics. If you want to understand Austrian economics, I think Principles of Economics is an excellent work to get started. But basically, the Keynesian economics comes from John Maynard Keynes, and he was an economist in the early 20th century. And his main motivation for Keynesian economics is, like I said, physics envy. It's this idea that economics is very specifically measurable, that you can put a lot of numbers around it, and that it can be more scientific, if you will, because you can throw all these equations and this works. That's how a lot of the mainstream economics is treated, right? What's the GDP? What's the unemployment rate? What's the interest rate? And what's this? And essentially, it's a lot of hubris. It ends up being that people don't act the way that you expect them to. The main basic assumption of a lot of the aggregate numbers and so on that you get from mainstream economics is based on Homo economicus. A Homo economicus is a perfectly rational being that knows all the information that they need to know and doesn't spend money if certain conditions, and they maximize for money only. And it's, of course, ridiculous on its face, right? How many people do you know that act that way, that wouldn't buy anything to eat if prices are going down because ramen noodles will be 5 cents cheaper tomorrow, so I won't eat until tomorrow or next week or next year or whatever. It's kind of a ridiculous thing on its face, but that's what allows them to generalize and make all these aggregate statistics and so on. That's Keynesian economics. Austrian economics is okay. Based on first principles thinking. It's based on how people behave. It's what you would call based on human action, the invariance on how people prefer things. So they would like things now rather than later if those are equally proportioned or whatever. If it's a good that's useful, they would like more of it rather than less, and so on. Based on those, you can derive certain things, but it's not based on numbers, which is the Keynesian critique of Austrian economics. It's that, oh, you're afraid of numbers and you can't do math. And of course, it's such a ridiculous kind of like cheap shot or whatever. It's that economics doesn't come down to numbers. It's based on what people want and how people do things. So among other things, you get very different outcomes or policy recommendations as a result of that perspective. So if you have equations and modes of thinking that let you say, okay, if we tweak this number here in this equation, then this side of the equation, things will change and so on, that's what you can do. And what Keynesian economists end up recommending is, okay, if you want to reduce unemployment, then you have to let inflation go up. But if you increase inflation, then unemployment, it's sort of like weird things like that. And then you get an entire decade of the 70s where you have both high unemployment and high inflation, which should disprove the theory because the equation clearly doesn't work. But that's not what Keynesians do. They just modify until it works on a lot of backdated data using something else. But that's, of course, not the way the world works. And their theories just keep getting disproven over and over again. Whereas yeah. The Austrian economics way is, okay, look at the first principles. Look what people prefer. If you lower taxes, then they will be able to create more businesses. Instead of this weird monetary theory of expanding the money supply as a way to control the inflationary pressures and stuff like that. Okay, that's just called stealing, right? That's how you would be able to look at it if you saw clearly through first principles. So I would say that's the difference. Obviously, I'm not explaining it that well. If you really want to know, go read Safdien's work, particularly Principles of Economics. He explains this in depth, and I can't recommend it enough.
Excellent. So okay. You now, if you would, give us a baseline definition for fiat, because obviously fiat is in the title, and fiat I see as being the tool, in a sense, of Keynesian economics. But explain to us a little bit what fiat is so we can...
Yeah. So the word fiat comes from Latin. It means let there be. So Genesis 1:3 is Dixique, and God said, fiat lux, let there be light. That's what it means. Mm-hmm. So if you said something like fiat pecunia or in Latin, that would be let there be money, right? So that's where fiat money comes from. It's money created out of nothing, fiat money. So it's become sort of like an adjective at that point. Linguistically, it's interesting because it went from a verb to an adjective, which doesn't, I think, happen all that often. But that's what fiat money is. It's money created from nothing. It's let there be money. And traditionally, that hasn't been the case. If you look in the Bible, for example, most of the Old Testament, there weren't coins yet. So people had to measure, a specific amount of metal. And there was something called the temple shekel, and shekel is a unit of weight. Most words for money or the currency in most places is related to some amount of weight for that reason. So the pound, right? Like the British pound is a measure of weight. It represented a pound of silver or something like that. Lira also means something like that, some measure of weight and so on. So it was largely linked to precious metals, although money could be pretty much anything scarce. Salt was used for a long time as money. Salary comes from the same word because people were paid in salt or whatever. That's how money was. Fiat money is not tied to a commodity. It's just issued out of nothing. And there have been many instances of this, particularly recently. The Song Dynasty in, I think, 12th century China issued fiat currency, and it hyperinflated very quickly. And the Bank of England was the first one that was sort of like a hybrid. It was a central bank-backed currency. And the idea of a central bank was to sort of centralize all of the gold. So it was still backed by gold back then, but the bank was doing fractional reserve lending. That would be where there's only 30 ounces of gold in the vault, but they've issued currency for 300 ounces, something like that. So that's what's called fractional reserve lending. You've essentially created money, created paper gold that doesn't exist. That still goes on today, by the way, with the gold markets. But that's what they did. And they sort of commoditized that or put it into the laws of England. So that fractional reserve banking, which in any other era would be called stealing, was made legal through an act of parliament. And that was the first one in 1697, something like that. And that's that model of central bank-backed semi-gold-backed currency was copied by nearly everyone, especially post-World War I. And post-World War II, instead of backing by gold, it had another level of indirection where every central bank was backed by the U.S. dollar, which in turn was backed by gold at the rate of $35 to an ounce. So that's 1 ounce of gold was $35. Right up until 1971, Richard Nixon cut ties to gold in what's colloquially called the Nixon shock. And since then, basically all central bank-backed fiat currency has been completely backed by nothing. So when we call something fiat, it's just sort of made up of nothing, right? It's rules made by man that in many ways defy the order of nature, the order of God.
When I hear money from nothing, I think of money for nothing, the Dire Straits song. So I'll have to try to work to get that out of my head. But it's a good explanation. I get it now. I can keep it in my head now, even if the words are a little bit different.
Yeah. And fiat money has been used for all kinds of evil things, which is what I write about in the book and why society is just so different since 1971 or so.
Yeah, and this is something that, just to put a biblical perspective on this, the Bible speaks very negatively about fiat money. You can look at direct mentions of this in Isaiah 121. You can go to James 5. It describes it as well. Almost all of the major prophets in the Old Testament decry the use of fiat money. It describes it as violence. It describes it as grinding the faces of the poor. And then Proverbs 11:1 uses the term unjust weights and measures, the biblical term to kind of describe fiat currency in a sense. It describes it as being that the Lord abhors it. And that's a special word reserved for especially repugnant things and sin. And so God feels very, very strongly about fiat currency, very negatively, and its use in our world. As you say, and I just went to page 2 of your book, you talk about exploring how this system that we've known all of our life, the system that we've devoted our lives to, the dollar system, which is a fiat currency, and that we've been participating in, is actually enslaving us. Which again, I think back to 2 Samuel 8, where Israel's asking for a king, and Samuel is saying, no, you have a God. God is your king. And they say, no, we see all these other kings around us, and we want a king like these other nations have. And Samuel says, okay, God's going to give you the king, but this is what's going to happen. And he ends with it saying, he will enslave you. And almost every time it's through fiat currency that's being used. So I want to bring that to bear as our listeners are listening to this, that this is very, very close to God's heart. So let's go ahead and Jimmy, I'd love for you to give us, if you can, a little bit of a summary or overarching idea of the ways you've seen fiat degrade our culture, our relationships, so many different
areas. Yeah, so the book is organized in six parts. First, it's making the argument that fiat money is evil. What you were saying about God abhorring bad weights and measures. There's also a lot of verses that talk to the debasement of the metal itself, like your silver has turned to dross.
Yes.
Your gold has become darkened, stuff like that. We read it today and it's like, oh, what does that even mean? And then you realize they were just diluting the metal. This is called debasement. And that was something that was common as a way to steal from people. And that's ultimately what all of this is about. So that's part one. Part two is sort of at the individual level, at a very personal level, how does this stuff affect you? And you might not think that it does, but it affects you in so many ways because the system, the way it's set up because of fiat money, it's very hard to save. Most people have one customer, their employer, and that's it. And so you're bound very closely to your customer and end up taking up a lot of the beliefs and stuff because that's your only source of income. That's the only source of making a livelihood. So you end up adopting whatever beliefs or moral standards that are allied to whatever employer you have. So that's at the individual level. Then a level above that is the company level. Unfortunately, this has come to dominate rather than families or communities or tribes or something like that. That's how we used to be organized. We're now more or less organized around companies. And these companies are enormous, right? Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that IBM employs like 200,000 people, which is absolutely insane. What are all those people doing? But that's how big some of these places are. Companies are, and the incentives at that level are very strange and are changed by fiat money. The nation state level, they've also become very bureaucratic and enormous as a result. And that's also affected by fiat money. And of course, at the global level, you know, the dollar dominance, the dollar hegemony, as I call it, has changed global politics and how, in particular, the U.S. deals with everything, even if it seems to have absolutely nothing with the security of the United States, like going to war in Ukraine or Iraq or Vietnam, right? They don't border the U.S. at all. What's going on? So I give some explanation of all of that. And then finally, another whole section on altcoins and no coiners and all of that and how it's important not to confuse an alternative to fiat as necessarily being good. It's really only Bitcoin.
A key partner for the Throwing Mountains podcast is the men's ministry CLC, Christ-led Communities. CLC strives to build authentic community through the uncommon pursuit of Christ, and it has had an incredible impact on the lives of tens of thousands of men, including Mike Hatch and me. If you're like most men, then you have many male acquaintances, but few or even no trusted male friends. With CLC, you'll join with other men around the person and work of Jesus Christ, and powerful things will happen. You'll see masks removed and honest brotherhood begin. CLC is much more than a Bible study. It's a relational pathway that equips men for a lifetime of biblically based leadership. For more information, go to clchq.org or email Mike Hatch at mhatch@clchq.org. Can we talk a little bit? So you mentioned that you take a look at things from an individual's perspective. We could talk for hours about any aspect of this, and it'd be very interesting. But let's look at your average U.S. citizen. What are some things that he can, obviously, it's good to get an understanding of what's going on. But let's talk about Bitcoin as it exists today. What should I do about it? How should I respond once I gain this knowledge and I say, oh, I'm very uncomfortable with how things are going? What should I do first? What steps should I take?
Well, so the thing I'm trying to point out in this book is not so much that Bitcoin makes everything better, though I think it does make a lot of things better. It's pointing out that fiat's the thing that's ruining it, and it's the absence of fiat, not the addition of Bitcoin, that oftentimes is the thing that's really, really beneficial. So, for example, at the individual level, you have beliefs and morals and marriages and children and families and things like that, which are very much more, all of those things have been corrupted by fiat money. You see, for example, with the education industrial complex, with corporate art, HR and things like that, that a lot of people end up taking the beliefs of the people around them in those contexts, which are ultimately controlled by the people in charge of those institutions. And you get the woke insanity that you get right now, because these are not beliefs that have been argued for necessarily. It's like there is an argument, but it's not something that you discover through philosophical inquiry. It is more or less handed down through a centralized influencer or whoever is in charge or whatever. That ends up with all kinds of corruption into your belief system, into your morality, and many, many other things. Now, if you want to get rid of that, if you want to not have that influence you, you could try living like a hermit, but what are you going to do? Right. How are you going to live? How are you going to make money and all this other stuff? Mm-hmm. And this is where, if you believe that's the case, and if you believe the argument from the book, okay, yeah, it does corrupt families, corrupt morality, corrupt beliefs, and these are just at the individual level. There's many other levels. Okay, if you're asking the question, okay, what can I do? The battle is half over already, because you've recognized the corrupting influence. Well, now you got to think about how to remove the fiat system from your life. And that is honestly not that easy, because fiat penetrates absolutely everything. But Bitcoin is a great start, because one of the things I point out in the individual section is so much of the things that we do are due to the fact that we don't have good savings vehicles. There's an obsession with investing, for example, not an obsession that's historical in any way. Mostly through history, saving just meant keeping the extra pieces of gold hidden away somewhere or whatever. That was your savings. You didn't have to go and invest or look at businesses or stock portfolios or new real estate or anything like that. It's a lot of work. It was busy enough working for yourself. So having a savings vehicle like in Bitcoin allows you more free time to go and not be so bound to, say, the job that you're at. So a lot of people live paycheck to paycheck because they don't have a good savings vehicle. They know that it's going to be debased away from them. So instead, they spend it and consume and do all kinds of other things rather than save. If you have the ability to save, now you have the ability to set goals and try to pursue those goals instead of living almost a zombie-like existence. And that means that you can become more human in many ways. So you can go read the book as far as specific ways to remedy the situation. But what I'm presenting is much more about, okay, here's what fiat ruins. Here are the ways that it's corrupted. If you want to get out, here's your alternative. And like I said, not all alternatives are good. In fact, many of them enslave you just as much as fiat does. But here's Bitcoin. Here's something that lets you save. It lets you be your servant instead of you worshiping it.
I love that explanation. Thank you for that. So, Jimmy, I want to get some specific examples, and I want to look at a couple things specifically. First of all, I would love for you to explain, because I knew, like, listening to your Bitcoin Fixes This podcast, for example, and you would talk about this stuff. So it's fun to have heard you talk about this previously, because I know what you're doing now. When you were writing this book, you were doing things to write this book way back then, which is so cool. And I remember specifically you talking about airline miles, because look, I'm cashing in airline miles here in order to take a trip to Niagara Falls, actually, our family. And I feel so dirty. And so I'd love for you to share a little bit about why that is, how fiat, the corruption of fiat, shows up in that. And then I'd also love to discuss loan origination, mortgages, and stuff like that as well, just to kind of help people get an understanding of how this infects our
culture. All right, so let's talk about airline miles. One of the things I point out in the book is that travel times from New York to London have gotten worse since the 60s, right? That was over 60 years ago.
Interesting.
And it's gotten worse. So what happened? Aren't we technologically progressing? Aren't we moving forward? And then what's going on? Well, turns out that the airline companies don't really have that much incentive to go improve their product significantly, right? We've gotten maybe slightly nicer seats, and maybe now we have a screen and DirecTV. Maybe it's a little more entertaining, but the actual flight times haven't improved. It's actually gotten worse. So what's going on? What's happened? And this is a common thing in any fiat economy, and it's something that I've pointed out in the book. There's a deep incentive for stagnation, keeping things the same, because the incumbents essentially get to write the rules. So you'll notice, for example, that in most countries, the same airlines have operated for many, many years and oftentimes have gone bankrupt and been bailed out and so on. You have some new players and so on that usually can do things cheaper, which forces some of these companies to maybe go a little better or whatever. But what happened? Besides maybe the subsidies that the government gives, what's keeping these dinosaurs alive? Or why are Delta, American, and United, the big three in the US, how do they continue? Well, the answer turns out to be airline miles. And you're like, airline miles? What does that have to do with it? I thought it was just like a loyalty program. And you'd be right. That's how it started, as a loyalty program, to get people to stick to the same airline so you could get free trips and so on. Except it turned out that there were other companies that were interested in getting into your mileage program, because of course they could start their own reward program. Like if you go to Juiceland, for example, where my wife went, after 5, you get one free, something like that. Or after 10, you get one free. But if they're not compatible with another rewards program, then you're less likely to get into it. So there's a network effect to reward programs, which means that rental car companies and credit card companies, they won't want to sort of cash in on your desire for miles. What ended up happening was that these airlines started realizing, okay, we could sell our miles to other partners and they'll buy them. And this became a giant source of revenue, right? Because the demand for miles for most people just was through the roof, especially flights, at least back then, were a significant expense. And it's like, oh, I could get first class tickets if I get this many miles and this and that. And it turned out that this became the main driver. And in fact, we got a little bit of a peek behind the curtain during the pandemic because, of course, the airlines were getting bailed out or whatever, and they needed additional cash. So they went to the investment banks and said, all right, give us a loan. And they said, okay. And they've done this before. Usually the collateral that they would demand would be the planes themselves, something like that. Instead, during the pandemic, it was unique in that they were like, we don't want the planes as collateral. We want your mileage programs as collateral. It's like, what? What? You want the mileage programs? Yeah, we want the mileage programs. Wow. Why? Because that was the most profitable part of their business. So they wanted the mileage programs. And what was absolutely startling was that the mileage programs had a higher valuation than the entire company. So Delta...
That is crazy.
Absolutely nuts, right? I think American had like a market cap of like $10 billion, but the investment banks gave a valuation on their mileage program of like $20 billion. So what? Wait, what? That's like finding out your kitchen is worth $2 million in a house that's worth $1 million. It doesn't make any sense, right?
Yeah, right.
But this is the reason. It's because they can essentially sell these miles at any time to the market, right? This is future revenue that they can book now. They can bring forward consumption. And the only way to redeem them is either they expire, which it does in some cases, or people use them for trips. And they manipulate the redemption windows and the amount that you need to pay for a redemption in such a way so that they lose the least amount of money. So it's this very, very nice thing. Oh, yeah. And the way I describe it in the book is they're really banks that issue their own currency. It's called airline miles. And sometimes they'll debase the miles, for example. I think United did that like a few months ago where their miles are now like just cash or whatever based on the price of the ticket or something like that. And that's what they are, is that they're banks that discharge their debt by operating an airline more than an airline that's using miles to... So it turns out the house is worth $2 million and the kitchen is worth like negative something, right? The airline business is really just a bank operating. That's something that most people have no idea about. But you look into the economy and most large businesses have some dynamic like this. So a lot of businesses will give up.
I'm sorry. Hold on, Jamie. I'm going to interrupt you for just a minute because I want to ask you this. Because one of the things you also mentioned with regards to this is how the miles are our benefit, and they in some way exploit those who are more vulnerable financially and are preyed upon with high interest rates through credit cards. Maybe I'm taking this on a tangent, but can you just make that connection?
Well, first of all, most of these like credit cards or whatever, they'll give you like 50,000 miles for signing up for their credit card. And that's good enough for 2 round trip tickets in the US or something like that. Well, that's sold to the credit card and the credit card company is essentially paying their airline, but that's subsidized by the people that are lower on the hierarchy of airlines. And basically the people with the highest status in the airline game, they get free upgrades and stuff like that, the better seats and all that. Whereas if you're poor, then you have to pay for all of that. Like I want an exit row seat. Now you have to pay $40 extra and so on. So it ends up being completely regressive in financial structure. The people that are the poorest pay the most. That ends up happening in almost everything. They end up benefiting the rich. That's true also of credit cards and stuff like that. If you try to play this game and then you get caught in credit card debt or whatever, then that's even worse for you. But almost all of these dynamics that I described about the airline industry, it's happening in lots of other places. And it's almost always regressive because of the games that you can play up at the top. For example, a giant company might have a leasing program for some of their equipment or something like that. And that comes through newly printed money. That's the financial game that they can play for more of their products. And this is a way to pad sales or to do more sales by having this financial instrument available. Airlines are just one example of it, but pretty much every large company in any industry has some financial game that they can play so that they get more of the printed money and not necessarily profit as a result of providing value. That's the sad reality of most companies today. And that's something that I point out in that section of the book.
That's a really interesting analogy or example, airline miles, because I was a heavy business traveler for most of my career. One trip or more, literally around the world. And I tended to fly one of the big airlines and I had a ton of miles on all of them. And I had the illusion that these miles were eventually going to be worth a lot of money. And then I retired from tech and my miles started to evaporate. They expired, a lot of them. But I had like 100,000 on one airline and I had 90 on another. And so my wife and I were planning to visit her daughter in California and then make a trip to Ohio to see my kids around Christmas time a couple years ago and then come back to Florida. And I figure, well, I've got 190,000 miles and they sell it with 25,000 for a round trip ticket, right? I ended up burning all my miles just to get 2 tickets to California and 2 to Ohio. Didn't even pay for the trip back to Florida because there's all these, oh, well, it's 25,000 if you fly at 3 in the morning, and there's all these restrictions and it's a bunch of games. So to get reasonable flight times on reasonable trips, all my miles.
Yeah, I mean, that's their version of debasement. It used to be that you could get any flight for 25,000 miles.
Right.
True 20 years
no,
ago.
No,
not true now. Right. That's done on a continual basis so that they can sort of discharge the debt that they have. Essentially, every airline mile that exists is debt that they have to pay off. And they can issue you debt for real money, right? Like, this is a crazy thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
But it's a giant Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, well, I mean, but this is also how fiat money works.
That's exactly right. Yeah, fiat is a giant Ponzi scheme in and of itself. Right, yeah. Exactly. So thank you for that. I really appreciate it. I'm going to actually bypass the other question I had, the mm-hmm. mortgage or origination loan, because I want to get to one other piece. The idea of how fiat affects us relationally as people, debasing in so many ways our character, who we are, our integrity, all these things. Can you speak to that a little bit? Yeah,
the sad part is that we've grown way too dependent on the safety nets that are provided for us. So it used to be that you had to depend on your family and the relationships, your community. That was completely normal through most of human history. It's only really with the advent of fiat money that we've become way more isolated. Why? Because you always have this safety net and you're indoctrinated in a government school for 12 years. And all of that has sort of made us less relationally dependent. For example, you have unemployment insurance, right? That makes you way less dependent on your family, because when you used to lose a job, you went back to your family, hey, like, help me out. And somebody would help you find a job or take care of you while you were trying to find a job. But there would also be some responsibility expected of you. Like, if you're not working, all right, you're going to go take care of some of the kids or work on this project while you're still looking for work, or maybe that's what you end up doing. But there was always sort of expectations that came with the taking care of you that would result from the community and family that you had. Now that's not the case. You just kind of get an unemployment check for 99 weeks or something like that, based on nothing other than what the government tells you that you're entitled to. So all of these no strings attached safety nets have made us less dependent on other relationships. And ultimately, that's meant that we're less close. We talked a little bit about the nuclear family having become normal. That was never the case for most of human history. You had a large tribe that you belong to, and that was like your protection, your source of meaning, and who you related to and everything else. That's not the case anymore, and it's unfortunately become way more normal to be this isolated individual that's completely dependent on the government. And you give lip service to being independent or whatever. Really, you're not. You're just dependent on something else that is faceless and doesn't love you and couldn't care less and will cut you off whenever it's inconvenient.
Hey, you mentioned it was your brother-in-law, right, that was going to seminary? So you did something in the 90s, I guess, that was pretty normal back in the 40s before the nuclear family, which was, hey, you move in with us, you can watch our kids, we'll pay you. And yeah, I think the nuclear family really came about after World War II. I think it was the 50s that became considered the norm. Before that, it was, like you said, it was extended families living together. And maybe you got your own place down the street. But a lot of times, married couples lived with their parents for years before they got their own place. And then it was just in the neighborhood. So, yeah, we don't see that because we all grew up with that. You know, that was the norm. But it wasn't so long ago that it really was not the norm to have a nuclear family.
Yeah, and then you get stuff like free public housing or whatever. Okay, well, we'll give you a house. You just have to live over here. And now you're more isolated from everybody than ever. This is the induced dependency. And the people in power like it that way, because when the more you're dependent on them, the more you'll vote for them and the more power you'll give them and the more of your liberties that you'll give up for them. And when they draft your sons and daughters, you can't really complain.
That's right. And I had it wrong. It was 1 Samuel chapter 8. And the king will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves would become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. So to your point, we've become enslaved in ways. It's got tentacles in our lives that we don't recognize. We don't see the ball and chain that's attached to us because we've been raised in it. We think it's normal. Okay, so I'm going to ask you for an impossible task. We'll see how you do. No pressure. We have about 10 minutes left. I would recommend, first of all, if you're listening, get the book. Even if you're not interested in Bitcoin, get the book, because I'm telling you, hopefully our conversation so far has convinced you that there's some real systemic fiat currency issues going on that are impacting us at very base levels. But Jimmy, the second part of your title is how Bitcoin fixes it. So in 10 minutes or less, which I know that's impossible. You're not going to be able to do that. But just whet our appetite, if you would. How does Bitcoin fix
this? There's a lot of corrupting things. And I think, like you hinted, a lot of things we don't even think as wrong. We just sort of accept as normal. And I don't know, I'm looking at the book behind you, right? Manhood Empowered. There's something that I think most people recognize as something being off, especially from historical norms and stuff like that, about how men relate and stuff. Like, what's going on? How is it that we've gotten to this point? Well, you're seeing a lot of abnormal things. The reason is fiat money. And the way that Bitcoin fixes the sins of fiat money is by removing fiat money. It's bringing us back to the original sort of human, where you had strong men that were willing to go and do things and had courage and weren't wimps or whatever, because they were empowered. They had the ability to contribute and they had families depending on them and they had children and stuff like that, instead of, oh, well, you know, if I screw up, then somebody else will take care of my kids, something like that, which is unfortunately the mentality of a lot of people. So the way Bitcoin fixes things is that it lets you get out of the corrupt system that is fiat money. It's essentially controlled by people, and those people are, and I'm not trying to say this, they're evil. They're straight up stealing from you. And instead of giving them that power of stealing from you and controlling you through the way the theft works, or the way they control you, is by saying, we'll steal a little less if you comply with what we say, or we'll give you a position in our midst if you do what we say. And so getting out of that system, I think, is essentially what Bitcoin lets you do. Now, how does it do that? Well, Bitcoin is decentralized. It doesn't have a controller. Instead of worshiping the money, you can worship God. It lets you put money in its proper place as a way to save and store value so you can go do the things that you really want to do. Unfortunately, all of that has been taken away through fiat money. Very few people have goals or dreams that they are progressing towards, largely because they're so busy trying to make a living. One of the things that I point out in the book is we've gotten a lot poorer in the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. This is not an exaggeration. It used to be that you could have a single breadwinner in a family, a large house, and 5-6 kids, and that was completely normal. Now, pretty much everywhere I go in the world, the wife has to work also just to make the ends meet. And if they have children, it's like one, maybe two. They can't afford a very large house. Maybe you have better entertainment with these phones or something, but nobody is actually that much richer in that sense. They have less time and can't do the things that they would want to do, at least from a historical perspective, what men have wanted to do, what women have wanted to do. So if you want to get back to that, you need to have a method of saving, and Bitcoin gives you that. If you want to get out of the system, you're going to have a money that's not stealable from you, that you can possess, that somebody else isn't going to come in and control you with.
That's great. I appreciate that summary, if you will. And it goes so much deeper, folks. So we talk about in the Bitcoin world that you really need to devote yourself to, I think everybody talks about 100 hours of research to really, really grasp all the layers of Bitcoin. It gets deep. I wrote an article for his Belt of Truth Substack recently called Bitcoin as a Monetary Plumb Line. And it's kind of analogous to Amos, where the prophet Amos, the Old Testament prophet, sees the Lord holding a plumb line, holding it up to Israel, saying basically, okay, time's up. I made you, or I use my incorruptible, immutable laws to set up your nation, to be honest and to be my people and spread a blessing around the world, and you become corrupted. I'm holding the plumb line, that standard, up against you, and I'm seeing that you are crooked, you are messed up. And basically, it was God's impending judgment on them. I know there's so many metaphors for Bitcoin. So this is my own, that I see Bitcoin as a monetary plumb line. And what's so transforming is you can hold this plumb line up all around everywhere in the world. And it shows you so much truth about how corrupt our culture and our economy has become. And in doing that, it also reveals, I believe, the truth about God's character. Because Whether Satoshi Nakamoto, the founder of Bitcoin, knew it or not, he abided by God's immutable laws of creation when he created Bitcoin. Anyway, that's part of why I think it's worth devoting the time to learn more about it and find out how it can impact you and your faith as well. So, man, okay, Jimmy, I want to spend so much more time with you, brother. I thank you. Thank you for the time you spent with us today. Real quick, though, give folks an idea. Where can they find you? Because I think I did a terrible job of introducing you, by the way. Tell us, where can we find you, man?
Jimmy Song on X or X.com, Twitter, formerly known as Twitter. I'm also Jimmy Song on LinkedIn, Gab, YouTube, and a bunch of other places. But I have a Substack, jimmysong.substack.com. You can go look me up there too. I'm kind of disappointed, Mike, because I thought we were going to talk more about the church and how it's been corrupted by fiat money.
Dude, I know.
Because like, when you were saying the plumb line thing, I was like, oh, he's going to go there now and talk about the church. But yeah, I personally think the church is all kinds of messed up because of fiat money. We kind of got a taste of it during the pandemic with how many of them just complied completely to the state as a result. They're not an independent voice anymore because they all got PPP loans. They all got significant bailouts, essentially, from the government. And they are now owned in many ways. And it's very sad to see.
Oh, yes. So I apologize. I did underestimate how much time we would spend laying a foundation. So we probably should have you back on to talk more about that, I think.
Jimmy, you've got a podcast.
Bitcoin Fixes This. And that's on, I guess, Spotify for podcasters. So you can go look that up there.
Yeah. So Jimmy, you and I will talk offline. We'll get you set up again because I really was looking forward to that because, you know, our audience is not as familiar with Bitcoins. There's more of a foundation to lay there. So anyway, thank you for being on, Jimmy. I want to pray for you before we let you go, though. Okay. Heavenly Father, thank you so much. Again, thank you for Jimmy. Thank you for what you've called him to, God, the mission you have him on, Lord. It's so important, Father. In so many ways, you are using Bitcoin and those who are educating others about it and trying to be that redemptive impact in our culture, God. I'm just so grateful for his efforts, both for me personally and for so many other people, God. Thank you for his family. God, I pray your protection over them and his marriage, especially, Lord. And God, that you would continue to empower them by your Holy Spirit to walk in step with your Spirit and to fulfill the mission that you've called them to, God. So we praise you for this time together in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. Thank you, Jimmy, for being with us, brother. Thank you.